Welcome, everybody, to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining us here on Productivity Book Group. I am joined today by Dr. Frank Buck. How's it going, Frank?
It's going great, Ray. Glad to be here.
Today on this call, we will be discussing Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time by Bridget Schulte. So, Overwhelmed, I'm reading now partially from the Amazon description. So Overwhelmed is a book about time pressure and modern life. It is a deeply reported and researched, honest, and often hilarious journey from feeling, as one character in the book said, time is like a quote-unquote rabid lunatic running naked and screaming as your life flies past you, to understanding the historical and cultural roots of the overwhelm, how worrying about all there is to do and the pressure of feeling like we never have enough time, that's a typo, to do it all or do it well, is contaminating our experience of time. And it goes on, but basically the book is about this concept of overwhelm, and it covers a wide variety of societal issues. The author, Bridget Schulte, is an award-winning journalist for the Washington Post. And she's a highly decorated journalist. She's got a lot of credibility behind her. And she also happens to be the husband of Tom Bowman, the NPR correspondent. So what Frank and I are going to do today is go through the book and sort of discuss the parts that we thought were salient and worth mentioning, and maybe do some constructive critique of some of the parts. And then at the end, we'll have a minor discussion on whether we'd recommend the book or not, and some other announcements. So that should be this episode. Pretty easy. So let's get started. So the book is about this concept of overwhelm, and Bridget starts off the book giving and setting the scene of her husband presuming that she was going to take care of Thanksgiving dinner, and he was going to go off and, you know, shoot the breeze with a friend of his. And what did that scene set for you in terms of what the book was going to be about, Frank?
Well, I thought it was really going to be more about time tactics. She starts off the very first page and she talks about some of the things that she's facing right then. The car tag sticker on the windshield has expired, and the cell phone has just disappeared in the seat crack. You know, all of these little things that we face on a day-to-day basis. And so as I was reading those first couple of paragraphs, I'm thinking, well, she needs a to-do list. You know, just start listing these things on there and then forget about them. Go about your day. When the dust settles a little bit, you'll be able to get back to them. But then I started to realize that this is very much a book from the perspective of a working mother, the role that women typically play in society, and a lot about the role that husbands typically play in society. So it was, needless to say, interesting.
I'd agree. And what it ended up sounding like to me was the book is more memoir than it was a book about personal productivity. I mean, there's lots of little nuggets sprinkled throughout the book. And I found myself wishing that she had gone into a little bit further detail about, especially in part five, she goes into some detail about her interactions with Terry Monahan, who is the productivity consultant that she hires, who Terry Monahan's based out of Alexandria, Virginia, which is my backyard. And so being in the DC metro area, actually Bridget Schulte and Tom Bowman live in Alexandria, Virginia. And so, you know, when they were talking about some of these locales, I was like, oh gosh, look, that's, you know, that's right in my backyard. You know, she's taken a trip up to College Park and other areas around the DC metro area that I'm very familiar with. So it was actually nice to hear those things. Actually, she mentioned the Delray Moms, and Delray is where my old office used to be, right there on Mount Vernon Avenue in East Delray. So really, really nice to hear about, you know, the local community and what they were doing and how moms are kind of dealing with some of these issues. But it was very much, for me, memoir. It was not really, you know, strategic or tactical material. And so I do want us to cover a little bit about what happens across the course of the book. She is, as the description on Amazon says, she has done quite a lot of research in preparation for the book.
It's really, I think, much more of a commentary on society and the problems that we face as a society. One thing I found very interesting, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it, when she talks about the Danes and their approach to the work week and so forth. I think it was them where she talked about the four-day work week for husband and wife, and that those would overlap so that child care was only needed for 3 days out of the week. So again, so much of the book having to do with how a mother takes care of her children and carries on a career at the same time. But the thing that got me was it was so much more of a commentary on our situation rather than a helpful way for someone to deal with their situation.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you, and I think that this was, again, it was a well-researched book and it was a well-written book. And before we started recording, Frank and I both agreed that the appendix that was entitled "The One Thing" was the best part of the book. So we're going to spend quite a bit of time on that. But I do want us to take a step back and look at the rest of the book. The book is separated into five parts, and what she does is sort of takes us through the journey of her experience of going from part one, where Schulte basically pulls you into the topic of overwhelm through her own experience and the experience that she seems to share with, or she observes as sharing with, other professional women, right? And I think that's completely understandable, and so I think the book is for the most part written for that audience, is written for a professional working woman. And so I think that anyone can glean good information from this. And I would actually say that there are lots of husbands and spouses that should read this if they have a working woman in the household with children. This could be really, really useful for your partnership.
Absolutely. And, you know, Ray, even the thing about the title, as I started to get into the book and then went back and just started looking at the cover to go, now, was there anything that should have clued me in that this is for a working mother? And there isn't, but I think it would have a wider appeal, or maybe not wider, but a more focused appeal, really hit the target audience, if something about the title had in it, you know, guide for the overwhelmed, a guide for the working mother, something along that line to kind of give you a heads up as to the perspective.
It certainly didn't, and that's why I picked up the book in the first place, and I never even thought to think of it differently. And it wasn't until after I had read it that I knew that this was a book that clearly markedly different than some of the other books that we have selected for Productivity Book Group in the past about clear things. Although, you know, books like Nudge by Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, that was more a book about society and societal change, not necessarily about tactical productivity stuff, but it was certainly in that vein. And I think this is where sort of overwhelm fits as well. So I want to make sure that listeners, if you do decide to pick up Overwhelmed, remember that this is not a tactical book. This is not about strategies. This is really one of those commentary memoir style books. And I think those could be incredibly useful, but just know that that's what you're coming into. So as I said before, the book comes in five parts. Part one, she calls Time Confetti, and she sort of entrees us into her world and the reality that there's all of this research being done about how time is being spent. And you know, like the research the researcher she meets with who tells her that she has, you know, 27 odd hours of leisure time in her week, that is, and she rebels against that idea and says, how is that possible? You know, she considers these kind of garbage scraps of time not actually 27 hours of true useful leisure time. And she goes on this mission to figure out how to deal with all of that. And so part two is about work, part three is about love, part four is about play, and then she closes out the book with part five, which is toward time serenity, sort of how she has come to try to figure out how to gain serenity and deal with all of this. And we'll talk a little bit about self-efficacy and so on and so forth. So I wanted to start with just, I know we're kind of like hedging the entire book, but I want to talk a little bit more about just some of the language here, in the sense that she talks about overwhelm. The book is called Overwhelmed, and it sounds like she was overwhelmed, but a lot of really what she's talking about is appropriate view of time, right? So it's about how she perceives time, how she manages her time, and how the people around each other, around her in her sphere of, or in her world, respect each other's time. So, from my perspective, I feel like the title itself doesn't necessarily represent all that she's really attempting to try to convey in the book. But I'm sure that that had a lot to do with marketing department and other kinds of things at the publisher. Where would you like to get started, Frank, in terms of part 1 through 5, covering some of the pieces and anything that stood out for you? And then we can really kind of skate through some of these pieces, because really, if you want to read it, you want to read it, but it's not necessary. The appendix is where we'll spend our time really summarizing and reviewing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the work part, chapter 5, the ideal worker is not your mother. And, she talks a great deal in there about, you think about the person who's moving up the ladder and the person who's rewarded. Well, that's the person who's coming in early. They're staying late. They're working weekends. They are really producing. And maybe that's a little bit in conflict, or a lot in conflict, with the ability to then spend appropriate time with children and family and that sort of thing. So I think she really sets up that problem of being successful mother and successful career woman in that chapter.
She also brings up, as she makes her way through the book, about, she clearly has a bent that, and I don't know if she necessarily takes a political side, but she certainly takes a policy side, which is that the public policy in the U.S. has set up a structure that engages workers to not just do hard work, but to overwork. And that in and of itself has created a fundamental problem, and that, the likes of her story about, going and interviewing, I think she interviewed Pat Buchanan, and his desire to create policy that basically kept women out of the workforce and working in a traditional homemaking role, and how that affected so much of American society up until today. And I think there's really a real issue there. When we talk about, U.S. society, we tend to think of it as being equitable, equal, and egalitarian, and yet we still have fairly similar roles dating back 100 years to women having to take on the role of caregiver and caretaker of the home and children while still working a full job, sometimes full-time job, sometimes part-time job. And this role can be reversed. Say if it's a stay-at-home dad, then it becomes the issue that he's seen as either weak or lacking professional competence. And if he takes on some of the work at home in a work environment, he can be seen as weak or, feeble, or any of these other sort of nasty terms that you would throw at someone to denigrate them in their role as a caretaker.
Yeah, that has been the stereotype. Definitely, I agree.
And so I think she brings to light something that we should all take heart to. We should all take an inventory of how we feel about these issues and how and what we can do to combat them. So if anything, part 2, 3, and 4 do is provides a basis for you to take an inventory of how you deal with and work with the other gender or same gender or whatever it is in your world in those partnerships. How do you respect other people's time, and how do you place them in these either gendered roles or in these societal roles based on what they do? And so we have a tendency to just lump people into that category. That is, if you're the homemaker, then I shouldn't ever have to pick up my dirty laundry, and you're going to do that. I frequently use the example of my mother. My mother is a career woman, and she is also Chinese American. And so she believes that she should be taking care of her four sons. She has four sons, two daughters. And, you know, in Chinese culture, it's really important for women to take care of their sons. They're very important. And my mother loves all of her children. But I can see how that caused a huge amount of undue stress on her because, you know, she didn't want us to do anything. She wanted to make sure that she was taking care of her husband and her children and doing it all, right? So working full-time job, taking care of many children. And it was, in hindsight, I didn't know this while growing up, but I thought, I think now, wow, that was insane. Why did my mother do that to herself, you know? And it's not that she did it to herself. It's that society placed these boundaries around, you know, women at that time and nudged them in the Sunstein and Noller and Thaler perspective into that role.
Yeah. I mean, those were the cultural norms. And those cultural norms change very, very slowly. But they do change.
And we're seeing some of that societal change happening today. There's no question about it. We have more stay-at-home dads in the United States than ever before. We have more women in the workforce than ever before. And, you know, the reality, though, is that we need to figure out a way that is, like I said, equal, equitable, and truly egalitarian. And I think that's the optimism here is that things are changing, I think, for the better. And I think that's the positive of all of this. So that withstanding, and the fact that, you know, neither of us are women, so we can't really speak about about a woman's experience.
Not a woman. I don't have children. So it pretty much leaves me out as far as looking. It in a way leaves me out as far as I can't really put myself in her shoes, but at the same time, it lets me look at the situation through an entirely different set of eyes.
She does give you an opportunity to see a different perspective, and I think that's very, very powerful for everybody. I as well don't have human children, but I have pet children.
Yeah, three Shelties. Yeah, which I'm just hoping as we go through this interview that all three of them, because when one barks, the other two feel like they must help them out. So we can go from dead silence to sounding like the dog pound overnight. So or you know in 2 seconds, and they say that dogs do not bark for no reason, but I have Shelties and Shelties don't need much of a reason. So
well, I have a miniature pincher. And he believes that if you walk within 10 paces of the house, that he needs to bark. He's a territorial little thing, and he probably sounds like all three of your dogs all at the same time. Smallest little creature, but the biggest mouth. but anyway, so I found part five to actually be the most compelling. It was also the most, I felt, compacting in terms of information. It felt a little bit rushed. And with all due respect, I felt it was just sort of pressured, and there was a lot of stuff going forward, and she put a lot of really interesting nuggets, but sometimes kind of tripping over them as she made her way through the material. But before we get there, I did want to cover that she talked about a couple of organizations and a couple of other things, and I wanted to provide a couple of other resources that I think are more useful and tactical in terms of if you wanted to delve into some of the research that she's doing. One is the International Association for Time Use Research, of which I'm actually a member. And so IATER is an organization that puts together a conference every year, and they publish materials of its membership on time use research. So these are social scientists who are going out there and studying people through a tool called time surveys, and that she talks about this in the book. And so the organization is dedicated to being able to help people understand the way in which people use time. And so I highly recommend that you you go out there and look for this kind of research. One place you can go to is a website called timeuse.org, and I'll put a link to all of these in the show notes so you can find them. And then the final one is the U.S. Time Survey, which is actually published by the, I think it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and so I'll put a link to that. But the Time Use Survey is a very interesting view of American society through the way in which we all use our time. And they can show a lot of gender inequity, pay inequity, you know, in terms of different strata, you know, from the poor up to the rich, and ways in which we can help create more and more just and equitable society, as they say. So I think that's really helpful. Also, one of the major pieces of research that came out was a book based on the research, which was Divergent Realities. And so the research back in the 1990s took 55 middle-income Chicago families, and they randomly paged them, back when pages were a thing, and they asked them to explain just in a little survey what they did with what they were doing at the moment in which they were paged. And so they were able to see how different family members were interacting and engaging with each other, husband, wife, and a child between I think the age of 10 and 14. And so they would randomly text message page them. See how that word just paging doesn't come to my mind. And so they were able to get an understanding of how people were using their time and interacting with one another. So Reed Larson and I think Maurice Richards were the authors of that. And it was our first glimpse into it. And as you can imagine, it was called Divergent Realities because women and men were seeing the way in which time was used very, very differently, right? And so women were clearly seeing it differently than men.
Yeah. I really like the idea of that pager because, you know, pretty much any time management book you read, it'll talk somewhere in there about keeping a time log. You know, you must know where your time goes before you can really do anything about it. But, personally, I've found that I never could make something like that work. You know, you either forget to do the log or, you know, it just seemed like something else to do. But having something that, you know, pages you where you don't have to think about it and just be honest about what am I doing right now when the thing goes off. So I did think that was a neat idea.
Yeah, and Dr. Csikszentmihalyi was doing something similar to this back in the 80s when he was doing research with Amos Tversky in production, of his research. And, you know, this whole concept of doing this randomized requests of people is really, really useful. And I think I think it's a better way to do it. Now, today, we have everyone has a smartphone pretty much. So, you know, you can have an application that prompts you, and that application can be even more rich because it's capable of identifying where you are, you know, what time of day. It's tracking all of those things. All you need to do is actually just write down what you were doing. And even then, it might be able to say, you know, it might be able to just snap the screen of your phone to see what you were doing. You know what I mean? So there are ways in which if you're a part of this research today, it can be almost passive where the moment you open up the phone, it recognizes the first app you go to, and then it tracks how much time you spent on that app. And those things can be really useful. There are several applications out there today that do that. Instant is one of them, and I'll put a link to the Instant app in the show notes. And, you know, it tells you how much time you spent on your phone and which applications you use the most. It tells you how many steps you took today. It tells you how long you slept based on, you know, trying to analyze the time your phone was dormant while you set it down for the night, and some other, you know, things that, you know, it's really useful to get that kind of information about oneself. So, you know, I think there are ways in which time use and time surveying can be really powerful today where it doesn't require active tracking. It can be passive and provide you with some information there. Let's get into the appendix because this is my favorite part of the book and I think the most useful. So she separates the appendix called Do One Thing, and I have it here as page 278 in my electronic version. So she breaks it down into work, love, play, and goes through those sections one by one. So under the work section Frank, what were some of the things that kind of stood out for you in the work section?
Love the very first point. I think we need a billboard that says that time is power. Don't give yours away. I thought that's so powerful. Yeah, really, the only thing we have is our time. You know, every good thing that we do happens through the dimension of time. And so, you know, the next time that, hey, you got a minute. Hey, can you come read this? Hey, can you come do that? That, you know, be careful what you say yes to, because pretty soon you're out of time. And then you're, like the book says, you're overwhelmed, and it's really nobody's fault but our own, because we have the power to say no. So time is power. Don't give yours away.
Yeah, and she also talks about this idea of the kind of wasted time that people spend with one another. It's not truly quality time that you spend with one another. And I don't remember the exact bullet point here, but she basically says that if you're going to be with the other people in your life, make it quality time. Don't make it, you know, this sort of useless time. You know, like if you're going to spend time with people, you know, it's not worth doing that in front of the television, right? Because that's not quality one-to-one time. And I really like that message as well. She also talks about the implicit bias that we all have, and we've already talked about this, that, you know, men should be in a career and women should be in the home, and we should really try to understand that, you know. And if that is your belief currently, recognizing that is a first step, right? You know, and it's not that you're wrong. You were cultured and raised to believe certain things, and society's changing. And quite honestly, if America is to stay in its position of dominance, if you want to call it that, one of the richest nations in the world, if not the richest nation in the world, or certainly the most powerful in terms of military might, we certainly need to do what we can to shore up the current situation in the country, right? Which is that we see that there's a huge workforce redevelopment that's required. Technology has taken jobs. It's not taking jobs. It has taken those jobs. People are trying to figure out what to do about those. And most of those people come from what would be considered sort of traditional family values parts of the country. So they are the ones who lost the jobs. They presume that the wife would stay at home and they would go off to do those kinds of jobs. And now they're out of work, you know, what were good paying jobs. And so I see some of this as kind of intertwined. Do you see the same thing, Frank?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, our cultural norms, they change, but they change very slowly. You know, my dad went to work every day while my mother stayed home and raised the children, and that was just sort of the way it was. And you know, in I guess two generation, you know, in the time of two generations, really, our whole culture has changed, and a woman can do anything. You know, it used to be if you were a woman, you could do two things: you could be a nurse or you could be a teacher. Other than that, you're staying home with the kids. And if you were a teacher, that was a good profession because your schedule lined up with your children's schedule. You were at work while they were at school. You were home while they were home. And now, you know, the door is open to women, and it's a very good thing in any profession. Although in many places they're dealing with a glass ceiling, where again, things change, but they change very, very slowly.
You make some great points here, and it just makes me, you know, I'm from a different generation, and I grew up never thinking that there were these traditional roles, and maybe it's because I grew up with a fairly strong mother. But as I retold the story earlier, my mother still had clear gender role and societal role issues, and I just didn't even notice it. So I think the reality is that making it more aware to you is really important, because we all have biases. I have biases. I'm sure you do, Frank. And we have to We have to deal with those stereotypes because that just makes us better people. And it, and honestly, it shores up and makes us better, you know, citizens. And I think that's really important.
And Ray, you know, when I was coming up as a kid, and you know, we're talking the '60s, mid late '60s, when it was when I was in elementary school, and even what you were taught in school, and not by design, it was just the way it was. Even your reading books, you know, when you read that reading book in first and second grade, it was the big brother who was doing all the wonderful things while his little sister just kind of looked up in awe. Many years later, when I was in college, I heard it referred to as the ninny sister syndrome. And so, you know, that's just the kind of thing that you were reading about. And it's very different today. If you pick up a reading book from early elementary school, very different, and very different by design. But so not only was that something we were experiencing at home, but it was something that we were really being taught subliminally in the classroom.
Yeah, that's really, really remarkable. So flipping gears a little bit in this section under work, she pulls up three other things that I wanted to talk about before we move on to other parts. So she talks about ambiguity, she talks about working smart, and she talks about this concept of overwhelm being a product of lack of control and predictability and the anxiety that are produced by that. Just a little bit about ambiguity. She talks about the idea that you should define a mission, set clear parameters and performance measures, and then satisfice, basically. So she says, when is it good enough and how will you know it? And of course, that is traditional satisficing. What's the standard that's going to be good enough?
Where are the edges? You know, and David Allen talks a lot about that, you know, that our work now no longer has edges. You know, how good could that report be? How many more websites could you visit to nail down an extra point or two? And that, you know, we pretty much have to make those boundaries ourselves. You know, interesting though, where she talks about the ambiguity is the enemy in the workplace. In other words, get rid of the ambiguity. And I remember very distinctly when I started a doctoral program, one of the things that we were told is part of your success is going to be based on your ability to deal with ambiguity, which didn't sit real well with me because I'm a very sort of black and white, you know, what's step number one, two, three, you know, where are the boundaries? And in so many situations, there really are not going to be boundaries.
And I think that's the nature of knowledge work in so many ways, because we just haven't had knowledge work that long in society. And as you said, society takes a long time to change. And I think society also takes a long time to learn. You know, it's not, it doesn't just one day we go from an industrialized society and then tomorrow we're a knowledge worker society and poof, we all just have imbued skills that allow us to be able to navigate that and work in this smart way as Schulte talks about. And so she says here, working in a new way does not mean working less. It means working smart. It means a healthier work environment and healthier employees, reduced healthcare costs, reduced turnover costs, and reduced absenteeism. It means innovation, creativity, and heavens, even profits. And I think this is an argument we need to really pay attention to, which is that for a lot of businesses and a lot of business executives, you need to really sell this from the fact that businesses are more profitable when they implement these new equitable, equal and egalitarian models.
Yeah, and you know, I just think it's smart if you want to attract good people and keep good people and develop good people. You know, if what you're interested in is just, you know, the bottom line, just get the job done, well, you can, you know, you can chew through people in a hurry and just replace one worker with the next worker with the next, with all the cost incurred in training one person over another. But the things that she mentions here in this one little bullet point are really some of the things that long-term is going to make a company successful. Now, really, you know, some of these bullet points, that one in particular, I feel like, well, you know, that could be our next book right there.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, she can, especially with her research skills, she could definitely find a lot about that. I wanted to touch on, since the book is called Overwhelmed, she says, overwhelm is a product of lack of control and unpredictability and the anxiety that both produce. I'm really curious about this because I always discuss overwhelm in the construct of it being a physical manifestation of an emotion. She's talking about it in a kind of a tactical way, maybe in the abstraction of not finding a locus of control. And I like both of them. So I'm curious about your thoughts here, Frank, as she says, learn from workplaces that have creatively embraced a new way of working in a healthier workplace culture. Find what works best for your organization, whether it involves using scheduling software for hourly workers, and all of these other particulars that she talks about. But what and how do you define overwhelm in this context? Did you agree with her? Did you see what she was trying to get at?
That definition really didn't do it for me. To me, overwhelm is I don't know what to do next. I can have 1,000 things on my to-do list, which I do. Of course, some of them aren't going to be done for a year, 2 years, get my driver's license renewed 3 years from now. Everything is there, but I'm not overwhelmed because I know what's next. And I know how to do that next thing. I think the overwhelm comes when we're paralyzed. There's so much going on, we really don't know where to start. We really don't know what to do next. I know there are times that if I've been gone for several days and I come back and here's a stack of mail and here are a couple of books to read and here are various notes. If I just take it and put it all in one pile and then just pick up the first thing and make a decision about what to do about it, I feel so much better.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that overwhelm is basically your fight, flight, or freeze response in response to some number of things that your brain is trying to process at the same time, right? Which is, and of course, there's ambiguity involved there or some kind of unpredictability. But as you said, Frank, it's about taking and creating a locus of control. I can put everything together into one stack and I can do the first thing. And as soon as you find that you're in control of that first thing, it's easier to then deal with the other things. And if you do that consistently across all areas of your life, then that sense of overwhelm starts to come down and become more tenable. So just for time purposes, I wanted to jump forward to she has the love section, and she has a couple of interesting points to make in the love section. Although what I found was that it's kind of a repetition of some of the items in the prior one, right? So check unconscious bias, learning to recognize, the ambivalence, and then getting rid of the ambivalence. What were some of the things that stood out for you, Frank, in that?
Actually, that same bullet point, the unconscious bias, and again, it goes back to the things that she's talking about in the book about those traditional male and female roles. We do have those biases, but to realize that they're there, to get them out on the table, to talk about them and try to work through them. And as she says, to make those decisions together. So if it is, husband staying home while wife goes to work, and there's some feeling of animosity, it's just not working. Well, what is really behind it? What are the feelings there that are driving those decisions?
She also talks a lot about some of these parenting issues and how to deal with them by having family systems, automating routines, giving your kids time and space, not trying to want it all, in essence, putting what she calls happiness first, while I would consider that fulfillment or contentment, not happiness. She talks about, sort of putting some of these what she calls true family values forward, right? Which is the idea that you don't need this this bemoaning and nagging and argument and resentment when everybody is sharing in the communal movement forward. And I think that that's useful to parents of both genders. I don't have children, at least yet, and so I can't speak to whether or not this is useful. But I found it to be. I think if you find yourself run ragged, this could be a breath of fresh air. Just these 10 or 12 bullet points.
Yeah, another one. That, having been a former elementary school principal for many years, one that just jumps out at me is this bullet point: "Park the helicopter." She quotes someone else in there saying, "Love your kids, keep them safe, accept them as they are, then get out of their way." I have seen so many parents, so many overwhelmed parents that were trying to just basically lead their children's lives for them. I mean, for goodness sake, you can drop them off at the front door of the school. They're going to be fine today. They're going to be safe and sound, and they're going to have a good time. And they don't need you emailing their teacher three times a day about what they made on the last test, And if they're on question three yet, it is just, don't helicopter. Save yourself a lot of time doing some things that would serve you better.
Well, fast forward a decade, and those are the same parents who would email me when I sent back I had an internship program at my last company, and I would obviously review these interns and write recommendation letters for them at the end of their internship. And I would get nasty emails from parents of grown adults in college, telling me that I needed to rewrite my recommendation letter because it was honest, and I would say to them, listen, your son or daughter had every privilege of being here at my company, and I gave them every, effort of my time and energy. They're going to get an honest review of their work. And this should be a lesson for them that when you do hard work, I treated everybody equally. Don't come to me. And by the way, why isn't your son or daughter in here? If they came into me themselves and said, listen, I think that this was an unfair, recommendation or unfair review that you submitted to my academic advisor, what have you, I would hear them out. But parents, I would immediately respond back with, what I said is what I said. There's no, I'm not budging. And that would be the end of it. But if the kids, the adults, I want to preface this. These are parents of adults. These people were 18 to 22 years old. They are the ones who are hurt by you constantly helicoptering, and I think it's really important for us all to take heed to that you can do more damage than good when your kid can't come to their employer or supervisor or otherwise and say, hey, by the way, I disagree with this assessment. That shouldn't be a make or break life or death situation.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We've got to teach young people to stand on their own two feet and let the parent, keep them safe, love them, but then let them, like the baby bird, the mother bird pushes the baby out of the nest, and that struggle, that's what lets the young one learn how to fly. And of course, the old story about the butterfly as he struggles to break free, and that's what builds the muscles that allows that butterfly to survive. You help him out of his cocoon, and he dies. So. Another one that jumped out at me down in the play section: carry around a notebook or have a note-taking function on a smartphone to capture the inspiration and aha. I think one of the biggest aha moments in my life, one of the biggest life changers, was as a high school senior when I guess was the most overwhelming time in my life. Certainly not the time, as I look back over my life now, that was the most filled with activities, but a time where I had more going on than I had a system to cope with. You know, it's where am I going to college, making those applications, taking the ACT test, and we got all-state band tryouts and, you know, advanced classes, all this kind of stuff going on. And I realized I need some kind of system. So an index card in my pocket, and you didn't see me without an index card in my pocket so that whatever landed on my radar that I was now responsible for went right on that index card. It went back in my pocket, and then I had earned the right to forget about it. And then when I get home, my job was to take that index card and satisfy it, to do whatever needed to be done, schedule anything that needed to be scheduled, where I could then throw that card away.
Absolutely. And I still carry, so those of you who are listening and don't know, Frank and I are both Evernote certified consultants. And so obviously we love note taking on some level. But I do still carry a paper-based notebook that I take notes in, and then obviously, you know, digitize that into Evernote either by taking a photo of it or typing those things in at a later time. And, you know, I just find it to be very useful for me to be able to always have no batteries needed ability to capture things, on the fly. And I take notes in my phone also. I have an Android Wear smartwatch, and I take notes on my watch as well. There are all kinds of ways in which I take notes. But when the going gets tough and things are flying all over the place, there's nothing better than paper and pen. And so I do rest on that that point as well, Frank. I think it's really important for people to take heed to that. And then the only last one I wanted to bring up, and obviously you can bring up others before we close out, Frank, is the one she talks about shortening your time horizon. And she says, what if we really did live like we were dying? and this actually comes up quite a lot in my conversations with people and their view on time. They think that they have this huge expanse of time in front of them. But if you narrow the time horizon shorten the time horizon to a point closer to you, then it's much easier to find motivation, and it's easier to feel more eustress, good stress, motivating stress. And I think that's really powerful to people. The one piece of research that I've seen is the idea of breaking up things into their smaller parts. So if you say you have a goal in mind, right? And that goal is to lose 10 pounds in the next 6 months, right? Well, if you say, okay, I'm going to take 6 months and lose 10 pounds, well, the reality is that you're actually less likely to lose those pounds unless you start to break them down into even weeks or days. So you say, okay, I have 90 days, or in this case, 6 months would be 180 days. Well, you could even break it down into hours, and I can't do the math. 180 times 24, right, would be 4,320 hours. If you literally say I have 4,320 hours, which seems like a larger number, but it's now on the most incremental units, 4,320 hours to lose 10 pounds is actually a better way to look at it, because it's hour by hour that you're actually breaking up your project. So just keep that in mind.
I think, was it Zig Ziglar that talked about wanting to lose weight at some point and did lose a considerable amount? And he broke it down and said, you know, I just need to lose 4 ounces a day. I can lose 4 ounces. So let me get out and run this amount each day. And I can, you know, if I do this, I can lose that 4 ounces. And that's all I need to do. And then I just need to do that same thing one day and the next day and the next day and so forth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of the inverse, right? Which is like, I can lose this small amount of incremental weight every day. And that's much more doable. And I think that creating actions around those things can be very, very powerful. So this brings us to the near the end of our conversation, and I just wanted to ask from you, Frank, what your greatest takeaway was from the book, and would you recommend this book to others?
I would recommend it to others, but not if they read the title. I don't think they're going to enjoy the book, because if what you're looking for is time tactics of how to not be overwhelmed or how to get out of the overwhelm, I don't think you're going to enjoy the book. I think if you're looking for how did we get ourselves into this, you know, the larger societal problems, how society functions, and just the theoretical understanding of society, then I think so. So I think there are going to be people that love the book. There are going to be people that hate the book. I'm more of a tactics person. I would have liked to have seen a book about a third this size that left me with some, here's what I'm going to start doing tomorrow to make my life a little better. So for me, it was a mixed bag.
I'm not sure I know anyone other than, say, my mother who I would recommend this book to. I mean, they're probably, that's not true. I have other friends who are working professional women where this book would probably resonate for them and would potentially be useful. The problem is that the book, again, the appendix is chock full of these little nuggets, but they're not fully fleshed out. So, you know, like, take a shower with a pink pig. If you just read that, you know, yeah, you'd have to go back to the book and read all the minutiae in order to be able to really understand its context and how to make it work. And I felt like there could have been a stronger methodology behind all of this. And she, like I said, it's a bit, little haphazard in part five, which is the most useful part. So I would recommend to everybody, if you're going to read this book at all, it would be part five in the appendix. And getting out of it these little minor nuggets where she talks about, you know, being able to do these tactical things that ends up being a strategy in a way, but it sounds just sort of like Jeet Kune Do of productivity, right? Just pull from the world all these tips, tricks, and techniques and mash it all together, and that's your system. And I felt it to be a little bit too haphazard for me. So, you know, while I think that it would be, while it's helpful from a sociological perspective, from an empowering book, it's a very empowering book, and certainly it's relatable. You know, it's well written, it's relatable in that sense. I think that, you know, it could be, it's kind of interesting. And again, I would categorize this more as memoir than as a tactical book, as you said, Frank. So if you're looking for that kind of book, then that is a tactical book, this isn't for you. But if you're looking for other people's experiences on their journey to being more productive, then I think this could be very, very helpful. All right. So this actually closes out the conversation for the summary review of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time by Bridget Schulte. So thank you, Frank, for this discussion and your insights today.
Thank you, Ray. It was a pleasure.
So I have a few announcements before we end the call. First and foremost, I want you to join us in the conversation about Overwhelmed. If you head over to productivitybookgroup.org and click on Community, you'll be able to join our new digital community and discuss Overwhelmed and your experience with the book's topic and themes. As well, please visit productivitybookgroup.org and find out the details and the schedule for our upcoming quarterly book discussion calls. If you plan to read with us, please visit the website and check out the schedule on the upcoming books page. Please feel free to visit iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podcasts, or whichever podcast directory or app you use to access Productivity Book Group to subscribe and also to review us there. It really helps to expand our readership and brings new readers and callers to the fold. So thank you. Finally, all podcast episodes, whether they be book discussion calls, author interview series, and summer review episodes like this one, are on productivitybookgroup.org under episodes. So if you missed one of them in the live discussion call, or you want to review an author interview or a summary review episode, head on over there to listen to it, and they'll be all there. So thank you again to Dr. Frank Buck for joining me. I'm Ray Sidney Smith, and this is Productivity Book Group. We hope you join us again next time. Here's to your productive life.